on air, online, on your smartphone, and on your smart speaker.
From WJFF in Jeffersonville, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Bruno. On today's show, more Americans are vaccinated against COVID every day, and coronavirus cases in the U.S. keep falling. Have we turned a corner in conquering COVID? Back in live with Dr. James Cruz of Wayne Memorial Health Community Health Center. The reporters round today, we check in with journalists from Sullivan County Democrat, the River Reporter, and the Shawanga Journal about local news from town halls across the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania. And Bob Dylan, he's turning 80 on Monday. Radio Catskill is celebrating all weekend long, and we'll preview the special Right on Target, So Direct, Bob Dylan's Blood on the Tracks, a celebration and exploration of the iconic album Blood on the Tracks. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Amy Held. The White House has set a Memorial Day deadline to get Republicans on board with a massive infrastructure plan. But NPR's Tamara Keith reports the two sides remain far apart.
The Biden team presented a counterproposal that would bring the price tag to $1.7 trillion, down from $2.25 trillion, but still more than double the last GOP offer. Most of the trims come from areas where there is bipartisan agreement, like road construction and broadband. Here's how Press Secretary Jen Psaki described it.
This proposal exhibits a willingness to come down in size, giving on some areas that are important to the president, otherwise they wouldn't have been in the proposal, while also staying firm in areas that are most vital to rebuilding our infrastructure and industries of the future.
The White House counter made clear the parties still don't agree on how to fund the spending, or even really the definition of infrastructure. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
More help could be on the way for U.S. employers seeking seasonal workers. NPR's Andrea Hsu reports a cap on guest worker visas is being raised.
The Biden administration says starting Tuesday, employers who prove they cannot hire American workers can seek additional foreign workers under the H-2B visa program. H-2B visas typically cover low-wage seasonal work such as landscaping, seafood processing, and hospitality jobs at resorts and theme parks. The additional visas come as employers have been complaining about worker shortages. To be eligible, companies must also prove they will suffer irreparable harm without the additional help. Of the 22,000 visas coming open next week, 6,000 are reserved for workers from Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras. Andrea Hsu, NPR News, Washington.
Tens of thousands of mail-in votes from the 2020 presidential election may need to be rescanned in the Atlanta area. Johnny Kaufman of member station WABE reports it comes after a ruling by a state judge.
The order comes in a lawsuit filed by multiple plaintiffs who allege fraudulent ballots were counted in Fulton County, which includes much of Atlanta. The judge ordered the county make plans to unseal nearly 150,000 paper ballots. The plaintiffs in the case will not be permitted to handle the actual paper ballots, but they're seeking high-resolution scans so they can conduct a forensic analysis. President Joe Biden narrowly defeated Donald Trump in Georgia, and the former president made Fulton County a target of his disinformation campaign to overturn the state's election results. Multiple federal lawsuits alleging widespread fraud in Georgia's elections have been thrown out. For NPR News, I'm Johnny Kaufman in Atlanta.
Major cities in India, including Mumbai and New Delhi, are seeing signs of improvement in their coronavirus outbreaks. But there is growing concern about the virus spreading in rural areas. Meantime, neighboring Sri Lanka has imposed a 4-day travel ban with buses and trains halted as a virus mitigation measure. You're listening to NPR News. An ongoing conflict in Mozambique has displaced more than 300,000 children. That's according to the aid organization Save the Children. The children may have been separated from family, have no access to schooling or clean water, and may have witnessed violence in the Islamic State-backed insurgency. And more than 1 million people in the northern province in urgent need of health assistance. That's according to the WHO. Wildlife advocates say legislation recently passed in Idaho and Montana could wipe out years of recovery in wolf populations. Troy Oppie of Boise State Public Radio has more.
Lawmakers in Idaho say the state's 1,500 wolves are too many and threaten livestock and other wildlife. Wildlife managers say reintroducing wolves 25 years ago is benefiting ecosystems and that overall wolves don't kill large numbers of livestock. A new law increases funding for professional extermination efforts. It allows hunters expanded use of traps, night vision goggles, and motorized chase. Bellevue Mayor Ned Burns, who is also a hunter, says the new law violates ethical hunting standards.
I don't necessarily know that that's the way I've ever been raised to hunt animals.
The new Idaho law allows hunters to kill 90% of the state's wolf population. For NPR News, I'm Troy Oppie in Boise.
China announced today its rover is now exploring Mars, studying the planet's soil and atmosphere. 1 week after the spacecraft touched down, it's a first for China as it ramps up its space exploration program. The U.S. also has an ongoing mission on the Red Planet. I'm Amy Held in Washington, and it's NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Jarl and Pamela Moan, thanking the people who make public radio great every day and also those who listen. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
Good morning. This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. For many, a nationwide return to normalcy from COVID-19 pandemic is expected to accelerate into the summer as more businesses and state governments prepare for large-scale reopening. Sports stadiums are filling up, mask mandates are being shed, and travel and tourism industries anticipate a rebound with cruise lines planning for passengers once again. Health officials have pointed out, however, that such successes are largely contingent on getting the United States fully vaccinated as quickly as possible. To check in locally, we're going live now to Dr. James Cruz, Medical Director of Wayne Memorial Community Health Centers, who's vaccinating people this morning. Dr. Cruz, how are you?
Good. Good morning, Tim.
You are
doing fine.
You are at a vaccination clinic right now. How is it going?
Well, it's pretty good. This is a second vaccine clinic. We always have kind of a rush first thing in the morning, and then it kind of slows down. So it's finally slowed down. Our vaccine clinics are slowing down without as many folks coming in to get a vaccine, but today's going pretty well.
It seems that that's a trend nationally as well, that vaccines are slowing down. Is that just normal because more people are getting vaccines, or is there still some hesitancy out there?
I think there's still a lot of vaccine hesitancy out there. I would just say Pennsylvania has 56% of the population have received their first dose. So that means there's a lot of folks that haven't even gotten their first dose. I know the Wayne County data is we're in the 40% range of have the first dose. So there's a lot of hesitancy out there. But I think what you saw initially was this huge rush of all the folks that were really anxious to get the vaccine. And then now it's more the folks who, they want to get the vaccine or they're thinking about it that are kind of gradually coming in.
Yeah, and it seems as if, given the recent CDC guidance about not having to wear a mask if you're fully vaccinated and some of the things I mentioned in the introduction about sports stadiums and, local tourism, that some folks may think that we've conquered COVID. Do you think that that's true? Have we actually turned a corner?
Well, I think we have turned a corner. We definitely haven't conquered COVID. And I think when you look at the trends across the country, in part follows vaccination, but in part follows the warmer weather. Because even for the southern states, like my home state of Louisiana, that doesn't have a high vaccine rate, but it's pretty hot right now, you're seeing low rates. That, I think, leads a lot of question of what's going to happen in the fall if we don't have enough folks vaccinated. Are we going to see the numbers really spike back up when the weather turns cool?
Do you think we've gotten our handle on at least community spread a little bit?
Yes. Community spread here is down a lot. I think it's down really. And I think vaccination has definitely had a huge impact. And community spread is down here a lot. But we have a ways to go on the vaccine front.
And you're there, talking to people. You're there at the vaccination clinic this morning in Wayne County. What are you hearing from people as they come in for their shots?
Well, the people that come into the vaccine clinic are all thankful and positive. Some have some questions about are they going to have side effects because this is their second vaccine. Those are the people, though, those are the people that have decided to get it. I hear a lot in the community about folks concerned about the science. Was the vaccine put out too quickly? You get some that are just kind of adamantly against it for whatever reason. But a lot of folks still have questions, and I really try to, on a daily basis, work on the, you know, ask every patient that doesn't have the vaccine, why aren't you vaccinated? What are your concerns? And really address that on a one-on-one basis.
We mentioned the CDC guidance about fully vaccinated folks that came out recently. You don't have to wear a mask if you're, you know, fully vaccinated. That came as a surprise to some people. Were you surprised being a member of the medical community? Did that come out of left field a little bit, or did you kind of get indications that that might be coming?
No, well, I think we knew that that was true for a while, that if you're fully vaccinated, you don't really need to mask indoors because the vaccines are very, very effective. But the question was, When do you put that out and lift the mask mandate? And I think it goes, you have to have a balance of, you know, the number of people vaccinated and low rate in the community, because, you know, the vaccine fails or you can get breakthrough cases about 5% of the time. So if community rates are high, you've got, you know, if 20% of the community is getting it, then you're likely to get a breakthrough case. If you get those rates down to 5%, then you're much less likely to have a breakthrough case.
And, you know, it seems to have caused us a little bit of confusion. I mean, if you're going to the grocery store, for instance, how do you know if everyone's vaccinated? What are your thoughts there? What was your impression when you heard this news come out?
This is my personal impression on this, without anything official, is I think that's okay. It is frustrating that folks that, you know, I see folks in the store that, you know, aren't masked, that aren't vaccinated and they're not wearing their mask. So that's definitely happening. You know, I think the guidance came out a little bit. It should have came out a little bit different. I think the CDC should have said, you don't need a mask indoors and at stores and stuff like that if your positivity rate, if your county is below this and your vaccination rate is above this. I think one is it would encourage more vaccination, maybe, and it really matters what percentage of the population is vaccinated and whether or not you can take your mask off. On the other hand, I think on the grocery store example, we really don't see much transmission in the grocery store anyway. So I think if you're one of those vaccinated people that don't have your mask, aren't wearing your mask, but you're worried about the other people in the store, whether or not they're vaccinated, I think you can really be reassured because, once again, very high rate of effectiveness of the vaccine. You don't tend to see much spread anyway because there's very transient interactions with folks. So I think you put those two together, and it's safe for the vaccinated, even if sometimes the unvaccinated aren't wearing a mask. The unvaccinated needs to be worried about that situation, not the vaccinated.
And also recently, children are now able to get the Pfizer vaccine at 12 plus. With Wayne Memorial, and we should mention Wayne Memorial is a financial supporter at WJFF, are partnering with camps locally to get that medication out to kids and camps in general. Can you tell us a little bit more about that initiative?
Okay, well, we actually have two initiatives that are being bring up. We have an initiative in the schools. We are actually having vaccine clinics in the school districts in Wayne and Pike County, and they'll be coming up over the next couple of weeks to vaccinate those 12 and up. And we also have an initiative with a camp, and that's really twofold. One is we're opening up vaccine clinics for camp staff, camp counselors, anybody that comes to camp that doesn't have a vaccine. They're going to be bringing them to our vaccine clinics and getting them vaccinated. Of course, that's all free of charge. And the other big initiative we have with them is a testing initiative, you know, because being able to test, identify COVID, isolate it if it occurs, get folks vaccinated, that's kind of the key to the camps being able to be open and have a safe summer. And the camps are very important to our economy. So I think it's very important that we do this. We're actually donating 28,000 free test kits, the rapid test, to 40 camps in our area, for them to be able to test their kids or their counselors if they have any symptoms or if they have any outbreaks or anything. So it's a pretty big initiative, about $140,000 for the testing. And we got a good testing grant, so we're trying to use this money to help our local industries, and one of the biggest ones are the camps.
Yeah, it certainly is a huge industry in our area. Last year, they were all mainly all of them closed, I believe. Some of those guidelines still apply, right, in camps, even though the cases are declining and you are out there with vaccine.
Yes, but I think we're going to be very successful. We've been working with the camps really all over the past year on their plans last summer about not opening or anyone who was opening. And we've been really talking to them all along about the plans for this summer. And I think they can do it very successfully. I think once everybody gets there, they've tested everybody. They're going to test everybody as soon as they arrive. And there are no cases. Then I really think they don't need to mask. A lot of the kids will be vaccinated this year probably. So if there's an outbreak, then they'll have to start isolating and masking. I think they are going to cohort kids so that they don't mix a lot, so that you kind of stay with your group all the time. In case there's an outbreak, they're able to isolate it better.
You mentioned also we mentioned earlier a vaccine hesitancy. You have a program that you're working with or starting this summer. Is that right, about how to tackle vaccine hesitancy, some funding?
Yes, we have a good bit of funding to address vaccine hesitancy, and we're trying to. We're going to start off, I think, with a telephone survey of folks that are unvaccinated on why they haven't been vaccinated, to really get an idea of what are the barriers or the issues in our community. And then we're going to probably do targeted advertising as well as other community events during the summer to really encourage vaccination. To really get at that hesitancy. And I think a lot of one-on-one stuff will help. The other thing I think we're going to do that'll hopefully help with vaccine hesitancy is actually get the vaccines in the offices. And this has been a challenge because of this cold storage issue. Pfizer vaccine.
Oh, I think we lost you. There you are. Okay, go ahead. Because of the cold storage, you're not able to get it into offices, but now it seems like that we might be able to get them into offices and easier for folks to obtain.
We're going to focus on some of our bigger offices that are kind of centralized, like our Highlands and pediatric practices, where they can open one vial in the morning. When they use a vial up, they open another vial. Because I think really folks a lot prefer to get their vaccine in their doctor's office. And you have that conversation with them about the vaccine. They decide to get it. You just go and give it to them now instead of having to have them sign up for a clinic 2 weeks from now. I think it'd be much more successful.
Yeah. And then we think we know, or at least what health officials have been saying, is that at least 6 months for these vaccines, that's how long they last, protection lasts. Do you anticipate we might need to see booster shots in the future? And if so, when will that happen?
It wouldn't surprise me if we need booster shots, but I also think they're always real conservative on their interpretation of the data. We're really seeing for folks that were infected, really second infections are very rare. I think we've had a couple in our area of folks that had an infection back last March or April and then got reinfected in January. So I think the vaccines are going to have a longer efficacy than they're predicting right now. And a booster will be... If they do have boosters, it won't be very much.
Okay. And, you know, it's a warm weekend. Folks are going to be outside. We've got, these advice from the CDC. What's your best advice, though, for folks that are going out and, trying to return to normalcy?
I think if you've been vaccinated, really, unless you have any significant health conditions, put you at real high risk, you really can do pretty much whatever you want to do now. I would be careful about going to bars or dance clubs or places that are really enclosed with a lot of people, breathing heavy, like a dance club or something like that. But I think for most events that aren't too crowded, whether indoor or outdoor, if you're vaccinated, you really don't have to worry about it.
Okay. And you're as I said at the top, you're at your vaccine clinic there. Is that how late is that open today? What can folks know? Is there walk-in available, or do you have upcoming clinics that you can let folks know about?
We're open until noon today. We do accept walk-ins. It's in the old Rusty Palmer building, right at Beach Lake Highway and Route 6, the big building with the cabin on top. And we have clinics here today. And then I know next Tuesday we have clinics down in Pike County, in southern Pike County in the Bushkill area. And I don't remember the whole schedule off the top of my head, but we have several clinics, both in Helmsdale and in, if you go to WMH hospitals.org, and click on the top of the page. There, it'll show you all the.
Yeah,
and we certainly do take walk-ins.
Okay, great. It broke up a little bit there, so I'll just repeat it again for folks who may have missed it. There's more information about the clinics in Wayne and Pike counties at WMH.org. WMH.org. We've been speaking with Dr. James Cruz, Medical Director of Wayne Memorial Community Health Centers. Dr. Cruz, thanks for talking to us today. Thanks for taking a break from the vaccinations and for filling in listeners on the latest.
You're welcome, and thank you, Tim, for getting the information out there. It's important.
All right. Be well. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay. Take care.
This is Radio Chatskill. We'll take a short break and come back with the Reporters Roundtable.
Pomegranates and walnuts, orange blossom tea, crispy rice, and caramelized herbs. This week, we talked to four brilliant Persian cooks: Samin Nosrat, Najmieh Batmanglich, Naz Deravian, and Behzad Jamshidi. Their flavors are phenomenal, and their stories are beautiful. That's The Splendid Table from APN.
Sunday at noon on Radio Catskill.
Be listening for Right on Target, So Direct, a deep dive into the Bob Dylan classic album, Blood on the Tracks.
Songwriting of the absolute highest order, there's simply no question about that.
The sessions themselves didn't turn out very well.
And he recorded, for the second time, half of the album.
That's Right on Target, So Direct, Bob Dylan's Blood on the Tracks.
A two-hour special, part of Radio Catskill's Dylan Birthday Weekend, Saturday afternoon at 2.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. We'll get a preview of that special coming up later this hour. But first, it's the Reporters Roundtable. Every month, WJFF's Patricia Rubio sits down virtually with three of our local reporters to discuss local news. This edition, they're talking about town and village board meetings, what it's like to go to those meetings and report, and what they're learning at those meetings. Part one of that conversation. Later, you can find the full conversation of this Reporters Roundtable at the Radio Chatskill podcast webpage on WJFFradio.org or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. Here's Patricio.
Today, I'm joined with journalist Owen Walsh of the Red Reporter, Isabel Braverman with the Sullivan County Democrat, Chris Rowley with the Shawanagunk Journal and News Atomic. And today we'll be discussing town and village board meetings, sort of what happens in them, the experience of reporting at those type of meetings and sort of pressing issues that are going on currently in those towns. This past year has really changed how the public interacts with the local government, because now a majority of the meetings are now being broadcasted on Zoom. Has anyone seen an increase in participation or in attendance during this pandemic? How about we start with you, Isabel?
Sure. Well, I've actually sort of seen the opposite.
Okay. I
cover two towns, the town of Tustin, which is mainly Narrowsburg, and the town of Delaware, which is mainly Calicoon, not to be confused with the town of Calicoon, which is not the hamlet of Calicoon. Some confusing Sullivan County history there. But the town of Tustin is continuing to hold their meetings on Zoom. And that is definitely getting, you know, some participation and attendance by the public. There's been quite a few people who have been coming to the meetings via Zoom. And that was sort of the same pre-pandemic, I would say, around the same amount of people. There's actually a very dedicated small group of people who come to every single town of Tustin board meeting. So they're continuing to show up. Town of Delaware has gone back to in-person meetings. They do not have the option of Zoom. And that actually is, I'm the only person there. I'm the only one who's been going to those meetings, at least recently anyways, I would say, you know, for the past couple of months. I think this is sort of on a different topic, but as with many town board meetings, many times people show up when there is an issue that they really care about, or there's something going on that they want to have their say in, or just hear about what's going on. So I see that a lot with Town of Delaware, where people do do come if there's a bigger issue, but you know, that's sort of a different subject. I think in general, though, like you said, having the Zoom availability gives people way more chances to be able to come to these meetings and hear what's going on.
How about you, Owen? You covering town board meetings or village board meetings, have you seen an increase or decrease in attendance because of the pandemic and that some of these meetings are being virtual? And I don't know, what's your experience in PA? Is it, are the meetings virtual there? Or are they doing a hybrid or?
So the two main local government things that I've been covering for the past year or so, maybe close to 2 years now, has been the Honesdale Borough Council and the Wayne County Commissioners. And actually, through the entirety of the pandemic, the Wayne County Commissioners never had any virtual options, and they still don't. They, you know, just kind of kept on meeting in person the entire time, just with, you know, the addition of having to wear masks and everyone needing to socially distance. And if they felt there were too many attendees for everyone to gather in their usual small meeting room, they would move the meetings to the courtroom, which is, you know, the big expansive courtroom. So they actually never had a virtual option. On the other hand, on the opposite end, Honesdale Borough Council went virtual pretty much the same time as everybody else did. All the other, you know, boroughs and townships throughout the area did. And they tried a few months ago to get back to some in-person meetings. And then that was kind of right before the winter of 2020 came. And then things, you know, numbers started getting bad. So then they went back to virtual. And now I guess they're sort of doing a hybrid where, you know, there's still the virtual option. I believe, you know, the press and the members of the public still call in and listen on their phone or their computers. But some counselors are there in person in the meeting room together. So it's kind of a hybrid right now. And I guess similar to what Isabel was saying, you kind of see the participation flux with whatever is being discussed at that meeting or kind of whatever's going on throughout the town. And that kind of has been the same both pre-pandemic and during the pandemic. You know, you would see probably the majority of meetings were pretty sparsely attended. There's kind of the same members of the press, obviously, and a handful of members of the public who would turn out to every meeting no matter what was going on. And then every now and then there'd be, you know, something that really just ignited the passions of the public. And, you know, it would seem like half the town was there. You know, a few specific topics stick out in mind. Probably the first time I really saw it, and this was before I was even a reporter, but I remember just hearing about how packed this meeting was in Honesdale. There's this like structure. I don't know exactly how to describe it, but it's in the shape of a star and the shape of a cross. And what used to be the case is that during the Christmas and Easter seasons, they would, you know, light the star and they would light the cross during Easter. And a few years ago, there was this group called the Freedom From Religion Foundation that said that because, you know, this star cross, this religious iconography is on public land, that it, you know, violates the separation of church and state because it, you know, is land that's owned by the borough. And I remember after that, you know, after the borough received that letter, there was an extremely well attended public meeting of townspeople who felt very strongly about keeping this star cross up on the cliff and not wanting to see it removed. More recent example that happened during the pandemic, so it was largely virtual, but just you could tell by the number of people who spoke during the public comment period, you could tell how well attended the meeting was. The borough had proposed this media ordinance that would basically do more to regulate the production of media within the borough. So according to the counselors, this was spurred by some company came to Honesdale a few years ago or maybe last year at some point and shot a commercial and closed down part of Main Street and blocked off part of the sidewalk. So some businesses and some people complained about that. So then in response to that, the borough kind of drew up this draft of a media ordinance that would require, you know, licensing and paying a fee and, you know, getting, you know, basically getting approval from the borough before creating media content within Honesdale. And the way a lot of people of the public read this ordinance, the way they read it, it seemed like this was going to be applied not just to major film companies coming into the borough, but also, you know, just someone who's on the sidewalk who wants to maybe shoot a video using their cell phone, or someone, you know, a couple of friends who are making a small movie and want to use the sidewalks of Honesdale. They, you know, were looking at this ordinance and it didn't seem to draw any distinction between, you know, a major film company, just someone shooting a video on their cell phone. So that was another thing that, you know, a lot of local business owners and a lot of just regular members of the public were very concerned about, you know, possible overregulation. So that was probably one of the longest meetings in recent history, just because there are so many people who came on to voice their opposition. But, you know, typically, I would say for the most part, there is not too much participation on a, you know, any given meeting. You're probably going to have maybe one or two members of the public talking about something to the counselors. But, you know, kind of is regardless of the virtual option, it's kind of what it takes is if there's some topic that really ignites people and gets them angry about something or passionate about something in some way.
Right. No, definitely. Definitely. I do see it. Definitely. Like I said, when it's an issue that definitely affects a lot of people and, people are definitely passionate about it, and especially these hyper-local meetings and hyper-local areas. Like I say, outside of the borders of that particular town may not matter, but this particular town, it does matter, and people do show up when they're so the most. How about you, Chris? What has been your experience with the pandemic as far as the attendance goes in town board meetings or the village board meetings that you cover?
Well, I've continued to cover Ellenville and Wawarsing in person throughout. And as with Isabel and also with Owen, you know, often I've been the only person there who isn't a board member. But, you know, this year I have noticed that the Zoom thing has begun to really, you know, accelerate. There's been more and more people. In fact, last night at a planning board that I did cover by Zoom, there were 25 people on. So I think that what Isabel said is what's happening. It's easier for people to attend that way. And so they are bothering to search, take a look. But again, it is, as Owen said, Isabel said, when there's an issue that upsets people, then they come, you know, it's, they show up then. And it's a curious aspect of everything. You know, everyone, we've all heard this, right? Everybody who writes for anything, anytime, you know, why do you always write about the bad news? Where's the, right? Well, you know, the thing is, the good news is fine, but nobody gets that excited about it, you know, whereas the bad news, wow, here they come, you know, it's an interesting contrast with what happens.
Now, like you talked about, like I said, these most attended meetings are that has those big issues that people care about. Chris, you could tell us anything that's going on in any of the meetings that you're covering now that sort of is a pressing issue or the hot topic, for lack of a better word?
Well, okay. No, so on the town board side, which we'll see this week at the Town of Wawarsing Town Board on Thursday, I would think one of the big issues will be the how are they going to deal with the American Rescue Plan funds, which are coming to, you know, all the municipalities in Ulster County. Ulster County is getting something like 32, 33 million, and it's going to be divided up this way, that way. And there's some interesting language about in all of this, because it turns out that cities and other municipalities are divided into two groups. There's there's those groups that belong to the entitlement side. So City of Kingston is entitled, and the town of Warsing is not. So the City of Kingston will get its money directly from the federal government. Town of Warsing will get it via New York State. So they will still get the money, we assume, and then Town of Warsing and the village of Ellenville will separate, split their $1.38 million, and you know, this will be a good shot in the arm for some. Anyway, so that's going to be an issue. Most recently, last night, there was a planning board meeting. And I find that planning board meetings are usually, or can be, the really exciting ones. This is where, you know, things break. This is where people discover that, you know, what? There's going to be development of that field that I didn't buy. My view shed is suddenly going to sprout 12 homes. Oh no, you know. And so that brings out the, you know, the furies, the NIMBY factor. But, you know, so those are the issues right now. NIMBY and the planning board and, you know, a reasonable chunk of money. Well, Warsing stands to get about just a little bit more than $1 million. And Ellenville will get a very much needed $333,000, which I'll be interested to talk to the village manager and the mayor about that, see how they are feeling once that money, you know, begins to arrive.
You're listening to the Reporters Roundtable. It's WJFF's Patricia Rubio checking in with local reporters Isabel Braverman from the Sullivan County Democrat, Owen Walsh of the River Reporter, and Chris Rowley with the Shawangunk Journal and News Atomic. We'll take a short break and we'll hear more from our local reporters right after this. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
Here's an invitation for you to join the party here at the Retro Cocktail Hour, where the swinging sounds of the Space Age Bachelor Pad come alive. Every week we serve up classic tiki tunes, private eye jazz, groovy bossa nova, and other incredibly strange music. I'm Daryl Brogdon. Join us for a hi-fi highball, the Retro Cocktail Hour.
Wednesday night at 8.
Every week on WJFF Radio Catskill.
On last week's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, our panelists confronted one of the most important issues facing us today.
Also, do horses have shoulders?
Yeah.
Well, I've seen them in strapless dresses that...
I'm Peter Sagal. We recommend wearing something loose but sexy for this week's news quiz. That's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Sunday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. We're into our conversation with our local media partners. WJFF's Patricia Rubio is speaking with Isabel Braverman from the Sullivan County Democrat, Owen Walsh from the River Reporter, and Chris Rowley from the Shawangunk Journal about pressing issues that they're learning of at local town board meetings.
In addition to the towns, I also cover the county legislature, Sullivan County. And there have definitely been a lot of hot topics, so to speak, recently, you know, especially in the past few months. Definitely a lot of conversations around the pandemic. And in the beginning, you know, it was like, how are they going to shut things down? Then it became a really big issue of the budget and how the pandemic was going to impact that. Now they're saying that they actually weren't in as bad a shape as they thought they would be at this time. So the funding from the American Rescue Plan that Chris was talking about will definitely come into play. They haven't discussed that yet, but I believe it is on the agenda soon. But a really big issue that has been happening in the county legislature is the county's nursing home, which is the care center at Sunset Lake. Initially, the county was going to sell the facility, they said, because of financial constraints, that it had been losing money, and that with the pandemic and the impacts that that was having on finances, that this was seen as sort of a necessary step to try to combat some of that financial hardship. However, they faced quite a bit of backlash from residents, the community, and, you know, people associated with the nursing home, such as the employees or people who had family members staying there. And they really pushed on the legislature to not sell the care center. And the legislators did end up changing their minds. And now they decided to lease the facility to an outside management company that is going to come in and manage it. And that was a process that took a couple months. And it's still ongoing now. They're still finalizing the contract with this company that, needs to be finished. And then they're expected to come in soon. But that really did draw a lot of attention. People are now coming to the meetings who may had never gone to the legislature meeting before. They're speaking during the public comment sections, and they're just becoming more and more involved. And so there are, just a lot of things going on at the county legislature right now, I think, that are drawing people to attend.
Definitely. And I've seen some of the live feeds. Sullivan County government broadcasts their county meetings live. Curious to see, I don't know how you can find this out, but be curious to see how many viewers actually watch the meetings live or, look back at it again post.
Yeah.
The meetings.
Some of the meetings, like you said, there are social distancing protocols in place. So there's a capacity that can go into the meeting room, which is at the government center. And there were a few meetings that were at capacity and people couldn't come in. Although they sort of took turns with some people leaving and some people coming in. And then you also mentioned that, yes, they do live stream the meetings, which they did before the pandemic as well. However, some people are asking them to, use Zoom or some sort of similar thing so that people can still watch the meetings and participate. Because right now, just with the live stream, you can watch it, but you can't, give a public comment. So some people are asking for that as well.
How about you, Owen? I know you touched on some of the topics that you cover.
For Wayne County in general, I would say that a lot of the things that they're focusing on the most fit under kind of two umbrellas, the one being infrastructure and the other being COVID relief. A lot of the commissioner's job the past few months has been receiving a lot of federal funding and state funding to help the local economy and help local businesses. And then they're tasked with, usually in a very short turnaround time, creating this application process for local businesses and people to apply for this COVID relief and then making sure that it's getting doled out fairly to everybody. And, that's kind of taken up, a big chunk of their time the past few months. And then the other umbrella being infrastructure issues. And it kind of ties into COVID actually, but one of the biggest issues for Wayne County at any point is the lack of broadband. The figure that I often hear from Commissioner Joe Adams is that one third of the entire county's population does not have access to high-speed broadband. In other words, access to the internet. And it's not necessarily in these cases, it's not that there are people who, could have broadband or could have Wi-Fi access, but just can't afford it. It's that, there really just aren't any companies like, internet service provider companies that are willing to come out to these kind of remote parts of the county and create the infrastructure that's needed to for them to have access to the internet. So the commissioners have actually tried to use some of the COVID relief that they have received to kind of increase broadband throughout the county, get more people hooked up to the internet. Because obviously, during this time when so many things have gone remote and virtual, it's kind of more important than it ever has been to have access to the internet when you need it. Some other infrastructure issues in Wayne County, there are quite a lot of dams that for some reason Wayne County has the most number of dams in need of replacement or repair than any other county in Pennsylvania. And they finally, it seems like the PA Fish and Boat Commission is finally getting some funding. They actually have acquired the funding to start repairing these dams and refilling the lakes that have been drained for a number of years. And, when you just look at how many lakes there are throughout the entirety of Wayne County, and you see that when they're filled, they really bring a high population of people coming from outside the state or outside the county just to come fish here, go kayaking or canoeing and just, you know, all these water recreation activities. It's a pretty important piece of the economy that's been missing for the past couple of years. So I think they're pretty excited to, you know, get some rehabilitation projects underway. Looking more specifically at Honesdale, I think I even talked about this, maybe the last two roundtables we did, or at least one of the last of the two, is that police coverage has just been a huge topic in Honesdale. It's the lack of police officers that are working in the borough. So Honesdale does have a police department, but it only has like three or four full-time officers. So it's, you know, not enough to have a 24/7 police force. And, there's, you know, a wide range of opinions, both on the Honesdale Council and just throughout the public, of people who some people feel that, you know, well, we don't need a big thriving police force because, you know, we have this PA State Police and they can come if there's some emergency. And it's not like Honesdale is overrun with crime as it is. So it's, you know, we really shouldn't be dedicating too much time and energy into this when we could put it towards other things. And there are other people who feel the complete opposite and say that, you know, the state police are located too far away so that their response times are not going to be fast enough if there's some emergency that happens in the borough. And, you know, they feel that it's kind of the priority that we should have over anything else is getting the funding necessary to have, I think it would take about 9 officers to have a full-time police force. So currently there's about a third of that. So it's quite a ways away. So you often hear the counselors disagreeing about that. And you often hear members of the public kind of weighing in with their 2 cents about it. The other thing that's pretty big in Honesdale right now, which is, I guess, a little bit more of a positive note, is revitalization efforts. So the kind of economic arm of the borough is the Greater Honesdale Partnership. And they recently completed a study looking at all these wide, various ways that they could revitalize the town, both in terms of, you know, kind of like marketing the town to people on the outside who haven't heard of Honesdale before, and also just, you know, literal fixing of sidewalks and building facades and just making it a more aesthetically pleasing looking town, maybe changing some of the, you know, traffic patterns and the way parking lots are set up to make it, you know, just a better experience for people who live here and who come and visit here. And it's going to be, you know, they recently just completed this study, so it's not, you know, going to be any changes that are going to happen overnight. It's several years out that a lot of these projects would, you know, it would take, I think they're looking at a 6-year turnaround time to get some of these projects done. And if they were to pursue everything that was covered in this study, it would cost about $9 million. So obviously it's, you know, not going to happen overnight. So it's going to take quite a lot of fundraising and, you know, kind of building up support from the public and obviously trying to get some deep-pocketed sponsors, you know, people who feel strongly about revitalizing the town. But that's probably one of the, you know, biggest things that both the council and the economic arm, the Greater Honesdale Partnership, are looking at right now.
That was Edwin Walsh of the River Reporter. You also heard from Isabel Braverman from the Sullivan County Democrat and Chris Rowey of the Shawangunk Journal and News Atomic, part of our monthly Reporters Roundtable, conducted by our moderator, WJFF's Patricio Rubio. You can find the full conversation of the Reporters Roundtable on our Radio Chatskill podcast at WJFFradio.org or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. Take a short break and have a preview of an upcoming Bob Dylan special. This is Radio Chatskill.
In the fall of 2016, Bob Dylan was awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature.
the first songwriter to ever win the award.
In the time of my confession, in the hour of my deepest need.
Tune in for a special playlist of Dylan's songs, selected by writers, musicians, and fans who all say these songs make the case that Dylan, the writer, deserved the award.
It's not dark yet.
Sunday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
There's something special about travelling on a ferry, whether it's across the river or across the sea. Next time on The Wagaload of Monkeys with me, Graham Rice, here on WJFF Radio Catskill, songs about ferries. Join me, please, on Sunday afternoon at 3.
Welcome back to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Believe it or not, Bob Dylan turns 80 on Monday. That's right. WJFF is celebrating it all weekend long. Today at 2, we're bringing you Right on Target, So Direct, Bob Dylan's Blood on the Tracks. It's a celebration and exploration of that iconic album, Blood on the Tracks. And it's the Bob Dylan album voted his best in a Rolling Stone magazine fan survey. In the two-hour special, music writers, musicians, and fans offer comments about Dylan's 1975 release, and host Paul Ingles talks with several of the studio musicians who worked with Dylan to re-record half of the album in the last days of 1974 in Minneapolis. Here's a preview of Right on Target, So Direct, Bob Dylan's Blood on the Tracks.
When I was playing Blood on the Tracks in my dorm room for the first time in January of 1975, Richard Nixon had resigned.
Always remember.
Back in August 1974, just 2 days after my 18th birthday.
Others may hate you, but those who hate you don't win unless you hate them, and then you destroy yourself.
By January 75, Haldeman, Ehrlichman, and Mitchell had all just been found guilty in the Watergate cover-up. Gerald Ford was president. He had just given his first State of the Union address.
And I must say to you that the State of the Union is not good. Millions of Americans are out of work. Recession and inflation are eroding the money of millions.
We were still in Vietnam and definitely losing.
A misdirected napalm attack by South Vietnam's Air Force. The victims, not communist regulars, but children.
And Bob Dylan had released this record, Blood on the Tracks. Now, I knew Dylan's music, of course. My older brother had his greatest hits record. But I was mostly hanging out with people who were too young to really have gotten Dylan during his mid and late 60s heydays.
It's hard to remember back in the early 70s. I remember one time I interviewed Bruce Springsteen.
Rolling Stone magazine's Anthony DeCurtis.
In the early 70s, around 73, 74, you know, people were talking about Bruce Springsteen as the new Bob Dylan. And I remember Bruce saying to me, he goes, you know, when they were calling me the new Dylan, the old Dylan was 33 years old. And there was a sense back then that crossing that line into the 30s, if you were a major 60s act, you know, the Beatles had broken up, of course. You know, the Rolling Stones, it was like, can they still rock? You know, do they still matter? And the same was true of Dylan. You know, he was an important figure in the 60s. But, you know, is he an important figure now? You know, Bob Dylan had gone back out on tour with the band in 1974, and that got a lot of attention.
There must be some way out of here.
He had been in a fairly removed situation, you know, at the beginning of the 70s. And even though he had some hit records,
knock, knock, knocking on heaven's door.
You know, he was regarded as somebody who had done great work in the past and was important. But, you know, he was not producing on level of what he had done. Bob Dylan's personal life began to get complicated in the mid-70s as well. You know, he began an affair with a woman who worked at Columbia Records, and his marriage to Sarah Lowndes was really beginning to shake. That marriage was very important to Dylan, regardless of his other shenanigans, and his breakup with Sarah became a public issue, became something that people heard about and read about, which really did not sit well with him. I mean, he's obviously a very private person. I think so all of this turmoil was something that was really kind of underlying a lot of what ended up on Blood on the Tracks. I remember interviewing Jacob Dylan one time, And he was talking about his father's work and his own relationship to it. He goes, well, look, it's one thing to listen to the classic stuff that my father did. And, you know, I can understand it and I can appreciate it. But when I listen to Blood on the Tracks, he goes, you know, that's about my parents. You know, it's that personal. And he understood that.
You know, like when we get to that.
As Dylan was living the turmoil of an impending breakup, he was writing. And in September of 1974, he went into the studio with about a dozen songs for Columbia Records again, with veteran producer Phil Ramone. Music journalist Jeff Slate wrote the liner notes to the 2018 release More Blood, More Tracks, which contained most everything laid down on tape on the way to that final album.
Well, I think what was most interesting when we put the tapes up in chronological order, got Bob's notebooks out, and kind of tracked what was happening, it became very clear right away that Dylan was making an acoustic album. It wasn't that he went into the studio with a band and didn't like the band and then decided to make an acoustic album on the fly because it didn't work out. He was first and foremost there to make sort of freewheeling for 1974, 1975. And he went in there, and if you listen, once everybody gets the sessions and listens to If You See Her, Say Hello and some of the other tracks that he cut on that first day, all by himself, the guitar playing and the harmonica playing and the solos that he takes are virtually identical every time. So he was really keenly prepared. Now his voice changes. He's, you know, trying to find maybe the character he wants to deliver these songs in. Then the band comes in later, maybe at the suggestion of Phil, we don't really know. You know, he tries a few things out and it just doesn't really come together. And so they end up trying a couple of blues numbers. And those work okay, but rather than getting better over time, they kind of started to fall apart more and more. So they'd gotten a couple of good takes, and those were in the can. And so he moved on for the rest of the week with just what he needed, which was he kept Tony Brown on bass, and he got, you know, did some slide and organ overdubs. But pretty much the album that he finished that week was mostly him by himself, which was what he originally intended, from what we can tell.
My breath, she studied the lines on my face. I must admit, I felt a little uneasy when she pinned down the ties and laces of my shoe, tangled up in blue.
Preview of the upcoming special today at 2, right on target, so direct. Bob Dylan's Blood on the Tracks. It's an exploration of the iconic album. Listen to that today at 2, and tomorrow listen to the writer's special. Music writers, musicians, and Bob Dylan fans were invited to write to music host Paul Ingles with a choice of a Dylan track since mid-1975 that they each believed demonstrated his worthiness for the Nobel Prize in Literature that he was bestowed in October of 2016. Here are their 9 choices in this hour-long special tomorrow at 4. It's all part of WJFF's Bob Dylan Birthday Weekend Celebration. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Remember, be kind, get vaccinated. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from Rourke Law, Liberty, New York, a general law practice serving the Catskills and Delaware River Valley with an emphasis on estate planning, estate administration, elder law, and real property matters. RourkeLaw.com.
Next time on Ask Me Another, from the Netflix series Special, we have Ryan O'Connell, plus actor Micah Stock and comedian Beth Stelling play a game about Ohio, which happens to be their home state. And podcast hosts Kenise Mobley and Rohan Padier guess which came first, sliced bread or the electric toaster. So join me on NPR's Ask Me Another, the answer to life's funnier questions.
Sunday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
Farm and Country is coming up next, followed by Catskill Character with Donna Fellenberg. Then it's the Janice Adams Show at noon and Staying Home with Josh Fox at 1. Today's forecast for the Catskills in northeast Pennsylvania, partly cloudy skies this morning, becoming overcast this afternoon. Temperatures around 82. Tonight, some clearing later, a low of 62. Tomorrow, mainly cloudy, a shower or thunderstorm possible, highs near 80. This is WJFF Jeffersonville, W233AH Monticello, public radio for the Catskills in northeast Pennsylvania.
Support for Farm and Country comes from Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, a community-supported, science-based nonprofit, taking legal actions, providing tools for action, and raising awareness of fracking damage since 2008, proactively protecting public health in the Delaware River Basin and beyond. DamascusCitizens.org.